Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Each week, we take a nonpartisan dive into topics related to the federal budget, the economy, and how it all affects our nation's future. This week, we'll begin with a look at taxing the rich, a popular option for many people for future deficit reduction. Concord Coalition Chief Economist Steve Robinson has looked into the history of the top tax rates and what they tell us or don't tell us about what the rich pay in taxes and how they respond to higher rates. Steve is here to discuss his new issue brief, Historical Tax Rates, the Rhetoric and Reality of Taxing the Rich. And that's available now on the Concord Coalition website at concordcoalition.org. And then after we talk to Steve, we'll welcome back to the show one of our favorite guests, Eugene Sterley, Institute Fellow at the Urban Institute. Sterley has written a new column titled Major Budget Reform Must Accommodate Legislators' Need to Give Money Away. An interesting proposition for deficit hawks that got our attention. And so we'll get his analysis of why he says that on today's program. And joining the conversation, Concord Coalition Policy Director Tory Gorman. Tory and Steve, welcome back to Facing the Future.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
Steve, you're usually a guest host on this show, but today you're in the guest expert chair. And judging by the clicks on our newsletter when we posted your issue brief on taxing the rich, you've touched a nerve. We had a lot of clicks. Don't know whether they liked it or didn't like it, but a lot of people read it. So let's get into it. You went through a history of the top tax rate and found two popularly held beliefs that you say are largely myths. One is that the rich pay little or no taxes. And the second is that we used to soak the rich in the past and we can do it again without any adverse effects in the future. What is the history of the top tax rate?
Well, really briefly,
so it only goes back 100 years or so.
Jesus.
Well, yeah. So actually more than 100 years. So yeah, the individual income tax was enacted in 1913. And way back when, the top tax rate was 7%. So, you know, the richest folks in the country paid a 7% income tax rate. But over time, due to primarily the World War I and World War II, the top rate creeped up and reached its peak of 94% during World War II. The rate stayed at roughly 90% until the early 1960s. The rate was cut to 70%. And then when President Reagan took office in the 80s, the top rate went from 70 down to a low of 28%. And then in the 90s and 2000s, the rate has come back up. Most recently, 39.6 was the high prior to the tax cuts in 2017, and it currently stands at 37%. So when you look across sort of the sweep of history, going from a low of 7 to a high of 94, and then in recent years, it's been in the range of 30%, you see a lot of variation. But the interesting thing is, despite all of that variation from 7 to 90 to 28 to 39, the amount of income taxes collected by the government has varied very little. If you look at sort of the effective tax rate, for all taxpayers, you know, it's been in the range of roughly 20-25% throughout history, despite the ups and downs of the top rate. And of course, what that really tells you is that the top rate applies to a very, very small slice of taxpayers. I mean, the top rate used to apply, you know, it's hard to compare the numbers because going back to the 1910s and 20s and 30s, a dollar then was worth a whole lot more than a dollar today. But, you know, the point is, oh, and of course, the other point is, in addition to the top rate applying to a very small slice of taxpayers, is that the top rate didn't apply to all income. You have, you know, interest, tax-exempt interest, municipal bonds that are tax-exempt. You have capital gains and dividends, which tend to be taxed at lower rates than other income. And then at one point, when the rate was 70%, we had a special rate for earned income. So if you had wages or commissions from some business, the top rate was 50% instead of 70%. So the top rate applied to a very small slice of income, and it applied to income differently depending on the type of income. So you see a lot of variation throughout history for the top tax rates.
And I think that you have a interesting chart that shows that what you were saying is that the so-called effective tax rate has remained around 30% when you look at all income, all taxes, and for the wealthiest, and has been around 20%, I guess, for...
Yeah, so in more recent times, I mean, for example, the Congressional Budget Office provides estimates of the tax burden, both income taxes separately and then total federal taxes. So it would include the individual tax, the corporate tax, payroll taxes, excise taxes. So they have a couple of different measures. And so if you look at the top 1% of taxpayers, they pay a income tax rate in the 20% range. And if you throw in all the other corporate, excise, payroll taxes, they have, in recent decades, past 20 years or so, they've paid an effective rate of about 30%. Despite discussions of, oh, the rich don't pay or they don't pay a fair share. And of course, you know, just like beauty is in the eye of the beholder, fairness is in the eye of the beholder as well. But, you know, effectively for the past several decades, the top 1% of taxpayers have paid, you know, roughly 20% on average for income taxes and around 30% for all federal taxes.
Tori.
So I'm curious then, you know, these polls all say that Americans believe that the wealthy do not pay their fair share of taxes. You know, based on the data in this paper, not so true. So where do you think that comes from? What feeling or what data gives rise to that opinion?
Well, I mean, you know, you always have the anecdotal evidence that there is some rich person somewhere who managed to not pay taxes. And actually, interestingly enough, the IRS puts out an annual report and they look at all the taxes. There's roughly 164 million tax returns filed every year. And among those, about a third don't pay any taxes. But when you break that down, how many of them don't pay taxes who are, you know, lower middle income versus upper income? You basically have, if you start at 200,000 and above, if you earn more than 200,000 a year, the IRS says that there's about 30,000 people out of 9.6 million. So there's 9.6 million people who make over 200,000, and about 30,000 of them didn't pay any U.S. tax. Well, of course, we tax income earned around the globe. So if you earn income overseas, we tax that. And we generally allow you to deduct the taxes that you pay to other countries against your U.S. taxes. So if you include all the taxes paid around the world, so your worldwide tax liability, that 30,000 number goes down to about 9,000. So yes, it's true. Out of 9.6 million people who make over 200,000, the IRS identified 9,000 who didn't pay any taxes anywhere in the world. And of course, one of the large reasons for that is tax-exempt bonds. There's about $4 trillion in tax-exempt bonds. That's the market value outstanding. So state and local governments issue bonds for roads and schools and bridges and whatever. And the interest on that is tax-free at the federal level. So if I'm a rich person and I don't want to pay any taxes, I buy some of these $4 trillion in tax-exempt bonds and I earn interest every year and it's tax-free. So, you know, the IRS says, yeah, there are people who don't pay taxes. And one of the primary reasons for that is we allow state and local governments to issue bonds that pay interest that are not taxable. Now, really, who is that a subsidy for? Is that a subsidy for the rich people who buy the bonds? Or is it a subsidy for state and local governments who want to raise money to build roads and schools and bridges? So, yeah, if you want to make the rich pay more, eliminate the tax-exempt bond, you know, the exemption for interest on tax-exempt bonds. But then the state and local governments are going to complain and say, well, wait a minute, you're going to make us pay higher interest rates, and we're going to have to make that up somewhere. So, you know, the dynamic is always a little more complicated than it might seem. But yes, it's true. There are a small number of rich people who by, you know, some means or another pay little or no income taxes, but it's a tiny, tiny fraction of the total.
You're listening to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman and I are discussing the rhetoric and reality of taxing the rich with Steve Robinson, chief economist of the Concord Coalition, who has written a new issue brief on that subject. We'll be back to discuss more about this topic with Steve after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman and I are discussing a new Concord Coalition issue brief on the rhetoric and reality of taxing the rich with the paper's author, our colleague, Concord Coalition chief economist, Steve Robinson. Tory, I think you had a question about the responses of the rich to being taxed.
Yeah, let me preface my next question by saying this. I'm not about giving, you know, wealthy people a free pass on paying their taxes. And those that aren't paying any taxes, I think, are to, you know, we ought to be talking about some way to make them, you know, pay at least the, you know, the effective rate for their income group. But as I understand in reading your paper, there are obviously some complications, some hurdles to get over when taxing the wealthy people. I'm wondering if you could help identify what some of those are.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you look across the history of taxation, you notice one thing that really stands out, and that is that the individual rate applies obviously to individuals. But as an individual, you also have, in many cases, or certainly historically, you had the opportunity to rearrange your business affairs as a corporation. So you could effectively incorporate a large portion of your income as a business. And so what you see, because there's a difference between the individual rate and the corporate rate, back when the individual rate was really, really high, the corporate rate was much lower. And so, for example, in the 1930s, the top rate went from 25% to 78%. And so, but at the same time, the corporate rate was in the 20s. And so what you saw effectively was that individuals who, I mean, a perfect example, you know, if you were a movie star and you were going to make a movie, you could incorporate. So you'd create a corporation and you would go and produce the movie and the studio would pay the corporation. And what happened was that after the movie was done, you could close down the corporation and the assets and all of the corporation could be converted into capital gains. And so, you know, you saw this throughout that period, the 30s and 40s, where wealthier people, there was a congressional hearing actually looking into these issues back in the 1930s, and they coined the term collapsible corporations. And you had, you know, the director Cecil B. DeMille, they cited in the hearing testimony. He did exactly that. I mean, he would produce a movie, he would create a corporation, the studio would pay the corporation, he would collect a modest salary, and all the income would go into the corporation and be taxed at the corporate rate, which was much lower relative to the individual rate, which would have been much higher. And so you see this throughout history where individuals who have a business are able to essentially shift their income from the individual tax over to the corporate tax. And because there was this differential in the rates, you know, the government still collected revenue. They just collected at a lower rate under the corporate tax rather than the higher rate under the individual tax.
So it sounds like a really easy policy solution to this is we just tax all income the same, whether it's capital gain, individual income, corporate income. Why don't we just tax everything the same way?
Well, sure. Superficially, it would sound simple. It's all income is income. We should tax it all at the same, you know, rate so that people couldn't move income back and forth between these different categories. Now, of course, economists will tell you that not all income is the same. So, for example, you know, if you earn a dollar and you go out and, well, you pay taxes on the dollar under this sort of theoretical system, whatever you have left over, you would go out and you could consume. And therefore, you earn a dollar, you pay a tax, and you go and buy something. The problem is that if you earn a dollar, pay a tax, and you don't consume it, you actually save the money and you buy stocks or bonds, you invest in a business, you buy real estate or rent or property. That dollar then earns additional income. Well, taxes on interest, dividends, and capital gains are a second level of tax on that initial dollar. And so from an economist's perspective, you have this, what they refer to as the double taxation of savings. And so you end up in a situation where the tax on consumption is low because there's only one level of tax. The tax on savings and investment is high because there's a second level of tax. And that additional level of tax will, of course, reduce savings and investment, and therefore it'll reduce economic growth. And so economists are always worried about this trade-off, that if you define income broadly and tax it all equally, you have what they call the double taxation of savings, which biases the tax system away from savings and toward consumption, and that affects economic growth. And so you always have this problem. And as soon as you attempt to address that economic problem, you then create the opportunities for individuals to play games with converting one income from one type of income to another. And so it's a real dilemma. So while it might appear superficially very simple, we're going to tax all income equally, it becomes a little more difficult when you consider the economic implications, and particularly the negative effect on savings and investment. And that's been the dilemma all along.
I think there was a really interesting chart in your paper that really shows the interaction between the top rate and reported income, whereas, and I guess this is perfectly logical, when the top rate goes up, reported income goes down. And the opposite, and your charts are pretty dramatic in that. And that's not showing an increase in tax cheating, so to speak. It's people taking advantage of some of the things that you were talking about before, of just shifting income. So Tory had, one idea about just taxing everybody at the same rate. Another idea would be getting rid of some of these exemptions, deductions, exclusions, things that are sometimes referred to as tax expenditures, because they have the effect of sheltering income. And most of these provisions, at least collectively, benefit those in the higher income brackets. So is that a way to try to help get more fair share, shall we say, from the rich without simply raising rates on a poorer system?
Yeah, I mean, the economists focus on marginal tax rates because of the negative effect. I mean, from an economic perspective, a tax affects the price. And so effectively what happens when marginal rates go up, the price or the cost of savings and investment goes up. And so an alternative, and this was a big theme, if you go back to the Reagan tax cuts in the early 1980s, and then, of course, even more so with the tax reform of 1986, there was this theme that you heard over and over about broadening the base and lowering the rates. And the idea was that if you eliminated all of the deductions, exemptions, exclusions, and credits, and simply taxed all income equally at a lower rate, you would get more revenue and it would be more economically efficient. And so there has been a push to do that over time. But unfortunately, politically, the deductions, exclusions, exemptions, if you say it a different way and you say the mortgage interest deduction, the tax exclusion on employer provided health insurance and pension benefits, and like I mentioned earlier, the tax exempt municipal bonds,
charitable contributions.
Yeah. So what happens is all of these loopholes that are discussed pejoratively, if we could just get rid of all the loopholes. Well, unfortunately, those are all very politically popular. I mean, if you remember under President Obama, when we passed the Affordable Care Act, one of the ways we were going to pay for that was imposing what they called the Cadillac tax. And so the idea was that some health insurance plans were overly generous and we shouldn't allow people who have really, really, Cadillac style health insurance be able to deduct all of that. And so we were going to cap the deduction on health insurance and as a way of paying for part of the Affordable Care Act. And Congress, of course, realized that that was really unpopular, that people didn't want to pay taxes on their health insurance, even if it was overly generous health insurance. And so it was repealed. Congress just said, you know, sorry, we just can't politically stomach taking away this goodie that everybody really likes.
Well, just to throw another wrinkle into this, if you have President Biden's pledge not to raise taxes on households earning less than $400,000 a year, some of these things are in the form of tax expenditures. And so that makes it more difficult to reform tax expenditures if you've got this income threshold that you're trying to deal with.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, lots of middle-class people deduct their mortgage interest and they deduct or don't pay taxes on their employer-provided health insurance and pension benefits. So if you limit the exclusions to everybody over $400,000 but not under $400,000, there's a lot of people with a lot of money between $100,000 and $400,000. And if you're going to take them off the table and say basically they don't have to pay higher taxes, we're only going to focus on the $400,000 and above, you know, sadly, there's a lot of rich people, but the income that we, you know, have available to tax at that level is not enough to balance the budget. I mean, it's just, you know, you've essentially tied one hand behind your back. And when it comes to trying to address the deficit, if you're going to limit your tax increases or your loophole closing only to people over 400,000.
But taxing the rich certainly makes good rhetoric.
Yeah. Because again, I mean, you know, if you notice in the president's State of the Union, I mean, he talked about there's 1,000 billionaires and they pay an 8% tax and oh, isn't that terrible? And, you know, it's actually interesting. I mean, his figure 8% actually came from a White House report that looked at the top 400 taxpayers. And they actually didn't look at the top 400 taxpayers. They looked at the Forbes Fortune 400, I think is it. I think it's Forbes, I think, that puts out the list of the top 400 taxpayers. And they looked at their net worth and what did their net worth do over time. And so when they calculated the 8% tax rate, it was not based on the income of the top 400 or the top 1,000 or whatever billionaires. It was the net wealth of the billionaires. And of course, we don't tax net wealth. We tax income. And so by definition, if you define an income tax rate as income taxes paid divided by wealth, that's going to give you a strange number. You know, it's not 8%. As I discussed in the earlier segment, the top 1% are paying an effective rate of around 20%. So it's not, you know, the 8% number is sort of made up by comparing apples and oranges or comparing income to wealth. And so it's not a reliable, realistic figure.
You're listening to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman and I have been interviewing our colleague, Steve Robinson, who's our chief economist and author of a new Concord Coalition issue brief on the rhetoric and reality of taxing the rich. We'll be right back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. And in this segment, we'll turn to a new column by Gene Sterley of the Urban Institute on why major budget reform must accommodate legislators' need to give away money. That provocative title got our attention. Gene Sterley is one of Washington's most respected experts on the federal budget. As I said, he's an Institute Fellow and Richard B. Fisher Chair at the Urban Institute. Among other things, he was Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Tax Analysis in 1987 to 89. He's also been President of the National Tax Association and co-director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. He also chaired a technical panel advising Social Security on methods and assumptions. So when I say Gene's got a lot of experience on the budget, he does. Gene, welcome back to Facing the Future.
Thank you, Bob. You know, sometimes when I get introduced by the fact that I have all this experience, it's just a sign of how many years I've been at it. But
we all have that problem from time to time. You know, you're also, I didn't mention, you're author of one of my favorite books, which is relevant to this subject, called Dead Men Ruling, which you wrote in 2014. And a lot of that kind of has to do with how much of the budget is put in place by programs that have been, you know, set in stone from years ago and determining budget priorities for today and well into the future. And it's kind of a similar type of thing that you're writing about here in this new column about the need to accommodate legislatures' desire to give money away. You know, at first you look at the budget watchers, you know, and you say, well, of course, we're always worried about this dynamic. But, you know, that's the reason why we're in this dilemma where politicians like to, you know, cut taxes and raise spending. And so I thought it was kind of interesting that you were talking about let's, you know, sort of recognize reality if we want to get into budget reform. So could you kind of lay out for me, you know, why you were saying we need to recognize this legislative desire?
Part of my concern arose from the fact that we budget people who keep insisting that the budget has to be made rational and balanced and so on are often accused of being hawks, which means all we care about is taking money away from people. And in point of fact, that's always the attack on deficit reduction efforts is, well, you're just creating losers. You're taking money away from people that they've been promised otherwise they're entitled to. And in the current circumstances where the budget is so far out of balance, there are people who think that our job, or what the job of say some commission that might come along or some empowered panel, or maybe lucky enough to have some president, is basically just to come up and identify a bunch of losers. And that's not gonna sell. It's never sold. And I think there's a reason for it, is that legislators and elected officials, including the president, listen if you want to any State of the Union address, and they'll tell you all the things that they want to do for us. And I don't mean just regulatory, but when it comes to the budget, it often emphasizes what spending increases they'd like to see, what tax cuts they'd like to witness or you know, foster. And they emphasize the good things that that they'll do for us. And my sense is that that tendency of legislators and elected officials to want to tell us what they are doing for us is not going to go away, and that any effort to really enact major budget reform has to take that into account. And by the way, that's not a criticism. I also argue that that's the natural tendency of people, for the most part, is to be optimistic. And I mentioned the fact that in the family, we usually talk more about what we're going to do and a lot less about what we can't do, even though we all live with budget constraints to tell us there's a lot we can't do. It's true even for the whole way our employment market works and the way the monetary authorities operate with it. You know, the reason why we try to have a little bit of inflation through monetary policy is so that we don't get in a situation in a recession that would get exacerbated where it's the employers basically try to cut wages, literally cut nominal wages. That's because we want to keep on what looks at least appearance of looking on the positive end. So I think that whatever we do in budget reform, if we really want to do it long term, that it's really crucial we come to grips with this issue about how can we keep available to elected officials the ability to claim they're doing good things for us. And let me add just one other comment along those lines too, which is that the government does not exist to reduce deficits. The deficits are the residual after we make all these other decisions. That's not the purpose of government, even though, again, we people who work on budget really talk a lot about reducing deficits. That's not the purpose of government. And we can't forget about these other purposes, which is that government has to adjust every year to the new needs, demands of the public, of the environment, whatever. And has to be able to adjust to meet and tackle those things, which is another major reason why I think our budget is so out of whack. It's not just the deficits. I think we're not doing the things that we should be doing. We might disagree what those new things are, but only doing what, as you and I talked about a little bit before, what dead men of the past have put in stone is not a way to adapt to a dynamic future.
Yeah, I just want to turn to Steve here, but I want to endorse that concept of deficit reduction, because the Concord Coalition, you know, some people would say exists to argue for deficit reduction, but it really has never been that narrow. What What we've always been focused on is long-term economic growth and the opportunities that that affords to future generations. And the concern about the deficits is that can be harmful if the debt gets out of control. So, it's not all about simply deficit reduction. Steve.
Yeah, so as I'm listening to you, Gene, it reminds me that you may recall back in, I think it's back in 2010 or 11, the Government Accountability Office issued or started a new series of reports on fragmentation, overlap, and duplication. And they were looking at all of the, basically all the government programs and how many similar programs were run by different agencies that were appeared to be doing the same thing. And a lot of people sort of looked at that and scratched their head and said, well, why is it possible that we have all of these government programs across all these different agencies that appear to do the same or similar things? And as you pointed out early on, is Congress wants to do things. I mean, you know, they want to solve problems. They want to help people. And, you know, for better or worse, occasionally when we enact a program and it doesn't work, instead of getting rid of that program because it's not working, we say, well, obviously the problem is we need another program and also a congressional jurisdiction. I mean, each committee has jurisdiction over different agencies. So if one committee creates a program under their agencies to solve job training or education or employment or whatever, and another committee comes along and says, well, we still haven't solved the problem, they'll go and create their own agency within their own jurisdiction. And so you have this sort of natural tendency for government to expand because of the division, you know, at the congressional level among the competing committees. And no one wants to get rid of anything, but everybody wants to solve the problem. And the way you do that is, well, obviously, if the problem hasn't been solved, you simply create a new committee. I mean, there is this inevitable sort of desire to solve problems, but you want to do it in a voter-friendly way. You can't take anything away, so you have to create something new on top of the one that you're already doing.
That's true, and I think that's very hard to control. But I'm going to distinguish between that problem and the fact that our budget's out of whack. Because my example, under the type of budgets we one time had, which were largely discretionary, is what happened to AFDC over time. The aid to families with dependent children was actually an entitlement. The new replacement temporary assistance for needy families is not, but it was an entitlement, but it didn't have automatic growth built into it. And as a result, it really, and you go to the 1950s, it was, outside of the elderly, it was the major program of the federal government for providing support to the non-elderly. And it basically waned, very seldom waxed. It basically waned or declined in relative importance over time. And it made room for other things like the expansion of what was then called food stamps, as well as the earned income tax credit. And eventually it became small enough that they did get some reform. So I think the problem, which we haven't really discussed too much, of programs that have huge automatic growth built into it, which is the source of much of our current budget problems, is somewhat different from the fact that bureaucracies tend to grow and it's often hard to get rid of the old. They're both part of the budget dynamic and things that need to be cured, but I think they are certainly somewhat distinct.
I thought that was an interesting part of the column, really. It's just describing that dynamic, whereas in the old days, most of the budget was discretionary and grew slower than the economy. I mean, Congress could make a decision yearly, and they had extra revenues to give away because they rose faster than the discretionary program.
They had to because of all the surpluses that were being
right. Now, with most of the budget being mandatory spending, it's the reverse. And so that's taken away that ability to have automatic giveaways every year. You're listening to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I are discussing a new column by Eugene Sterley of the Urban Institute called Major Budget Reform Must Accommodate Legislators' Need to Give Money Away. We'll be right back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I are discussing a new column by Gene Sterley of the Urban Institute called Why Major Budget Reform Must Accommodate Legislatures' Need to Give Money Away. That column is one of Gene's regular columns called The Government We Deserve, and that's available on Substack. Is that right, Gene?
That's correct. Thank you.
Very good. Excellent. Excellent. All of the columns are excellent. If you want to face the future, that's a good place to look. Okay, Tori.
Yeah. So, Gene, I'm sensing there's sort of two tensions here that we're talking about. The one tension is that there's this need for lawmakers to give back to their communities, to bring home the dollars in some fashion. But that at the same time, the discretionary budget is shrinking. So I'm wondering if there is a way, do you have any solutions, at least perhaps even cosmetically, to create winners rather than losers out of this scenario?
I've commented briefly earlier that, you know, in a discretionary budget, there really is usually no growth built in. There might be in the sense you build the battleship and now you start to have to put people on it. In some sense, I think that was even the issue that Dwight D. Eisenhower raised when he talked about the military industrial complex. You start doing things, it's often hard to stop them. But typically they don't have automatic growth built in. They will build constituencies, but it's not like they have automatic growth. And in our current budget, the major programs that are growing, mainly called entitlements, more technically mandatory spending, have built-in growth. In fact, so much built-in growth, they grow faster than the economy and they grow faster than any revenues we might provide. And what that creates is a very interesting dynamic when people talk about winners and losers, is that they define winners and losers relative to this unsustainable promise. The classic example I always give is if healthcare is growing at 5% per year and inflation's 2%, it's growing quite substantially. But if Congress would reduce that rate of growth to 4%, that's called taking away something from people and creating losers. Meanwhile, the education budget, which doesn't grow at all, even relative to inflation, and they manage to give it an inflation increase, often that's defined as a winner, creating winners. So even if education now grows at 2% and healthcare at 4%, the dynamic and the discussion in the newspapers and every place else is that Congress created a lot of losers in healthcare and a lot of winners in education. That's just wrong. It distorts how we think about where growth is going, you know, what programs are doing well and which ones aren't. But it also creates a fantastic dynamic when you're trying to just simply get the budget under control, in the sense of not having unsustainable growth and debt, is that to get the budget now in order, it's growing so much relative to anything that's sustainable, that any budget act that actually got towards sustainability would say that they're creating a bunch of losers. And actually, that's in the traditional sense, that's not right. So this may sound very technical, but again, back to the discretionary budget. Right now, the way we designed it, the way the Congressional Budget Office reports on it, is if we give some real increase to a discretionary program, that's called winners. We even create distributional tables showing sometimes the winners in this type of thing. But if somebody cuts back on these mandatory programs that have large automatic growth, the distributional table and the tables on the revenue and the spending effects will say we created losers. But relative to the past year, that's not right. So what's often hidden for a lot of people in terms of healthcare? Well, you know, I've been promised by healthcare, don't take it away. Well, in point of fact, healthcare gets better from year to year. And almost no one counts that source of growth, whether it's by government or, by the way, by the employer. Almost no one counts that as the addition to their income. And it's one reason, even independently of budget issues, disputes over what's happening to the income distribution and whether we have income growth in the economy really get distorted by the fact of how we're counting relative to what. Healthcare is getting better over time. That's been one of our major gains as a society. And a lot of times we say, well, we haven't had any income growth. And when it comes to the budget, we don't count the fact that, well, if we got healthcare into a more sustainable growth rate, that would still allow real growth in terms of what Congress is providing, but relative to some past year, not relative to some hypothetical promise that might not be sustained.
So is your point that we should just change the way we talk about it, or are you suggesting that we really revamp the notion of a baseline, of a budget baseline, and either ditching it altogether or going to something like zero-based budgeting, where literally we're looking at, okay, how much did we spend relative to last year? What are you suggesting here?
Maybe a little bit of both. I'm saying that in terms of defining the baseline, the way we present it, we people who work on the budgets can actually do that more. You know, one time I was a finalist to be head of Congressional Budget Office. And one of the things I wanted to do if I ever got in that position was to actually try to think about ways to present the numbers. And what I thought would be a more even keel basis, you know, Congressional Budget Office is not going to try to decide what's good or bad, but at least report on what programs were growing or not growing in the same way across all programs, which would be generally speaking, relative to some past year. Now, you'd also report on whether there was an increased need because, you know, there were new options for healthcare, or there were more elderly people. So there's a lot of reasons you might want to report on other reasons to increase or decrease a budget. But I think to report on them fairly in a budget is they should be reported in terms of relative to a past year. And I think that's doable, probably even without congressional action. Although Congress may decide that how they want things reported might be different. In terms of the policy, I think that the policy solution to our budget issues requires almost more than anything else in controlling this automatic growth. Now, by the way, I'm not saying we don't need tax increases as well as spending cuts to be able to get there. But again, now I'm in this box where I might be defining spending cuts relative to an unsustainable growth path, whereas on the tax side, I might be defining it relative to a sustainable path. So it gets a little tricky in terms of the politics of how it plays out. But there's just no doubt that getting automatic growth in spending programs under control is a sine qua non for without which nothing. We don't get true budget reforming and tackle this huge deficit issues that we have growing year after year after year.
When you brought this up to people at the budget committees, like when you were being interviewed for the CBO job, and I know you've interacted with lots of policymakers up on the Hill, what is their reaction to this? I mean, do they agree with you and say, well, it's too complicated to do it? Or do they just look at you with a blank stare and say, I don't understand what you're talking about?
Well, you have to realize that when you go into this, I can't remember if Steve was in these meetings or not, but when you go into this meeting among the supposed finalists for Congressional Budget Office, it's already been decided. And I literally had members of Congress literally tell me who were budget committee's chairs who decided this. One of them put his arm around me. He said, Gene, I supported you last time. Well, last time it was the Republican choice. The time he didn't support me, it was the Democratic choice. So I had this dilemma. I did have staffers who told me, so there wasn't much discussion at that time about what you might do. I had staffers told me that I was trying, by suggesting things at times, I was being too forward, that there was some sense among members of Congress they wanted a passive CBO. That it made it appear as if I was proposing things that should be done, which is the member's prerogative and decision, whereas I was basically just trying to suggest that I think there are different ways of suggesting things, but maybe I should have been more passive in my...
Well, I think you've actually done a sample of what you mean. I mean, it seems to me that at one point you did kind of a, here's how the budget could be presented. I don't know if you did the full budget, but I can remember your toying with this in the past. Well, hopefully we can get a hold of this and try to make some winners out of losers. Any final thoughts? We got about a minute left.
I just want to reemphasize that this claim of the past on what we do in the future and what new things we do for the future, to me, it creates enormous constraints that when I look at what happened to student debt rising, or when I look at the difficulty of getting more money when issues like the Ukraine rise, or I can go down a whole list of issues where at least I personally, and probably you personally, think we could do more. You might be more on the tax cutting side, but that this dynamic of having preordained everything, most of the money that we're going to spend in the future is really distorting our decisions when we face new crises or new problems. Might be the increased suicide rate among young men or whatever, that are new problems that need some new effort and new vision. And it's very hard often to build those into a budget where most of the growth, most of the spending growth has been determined by dead men, dead legislatures, and they were mainly men from the past.
That's where we'll have to leave it for this week. But unfortunately, that's where the budget is. Dead men are still ruling. But thanks for joining us and sharing your insights this week. That's all we have the time for. Tori and Steve and I will be back next week with another edition of Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. See you then.